Song of Blades and Heroes is a cult classic miniature agnostic fantasy skirmish rule set. I've been playing it for a couple of years now, and I wanted to shine a wee light on it in more detail on this episode, so I'm going to be talking to a pal of mine's who had a shot of it for the very first time recently. Robert, how are we getting on today?
Very well, thank you very much. I've been practicing my dice rolling and I'm very excited to talk to you about it.
Yeah, dice rolling, it's one of them. You don't encounter many people who say, I'm really good at rolling dice, do you? Like, I've never came across one of those folk. I just roll a lot of fives and sixes.
Yeah, it's more like, oh, my dice are terrible because sometimes they don't give me the numbers I want and I hate them.
Yeah. Are you a fan of the D6 or D20 or D12? Do you have a favourite dice?
I think you have a few more options with the D20, you know, a few more degrees of subtlety, whereas the D6, that's kind of like a child's die, isn't it? Because it comes with Monopoly and the likes.
Yeah, but also easier to find if you've just got an emergency game on the go. It's easier to obtain a handful of those.
Oh, yeah, you go and raid Monopoly and Cluedo and the likes and say, I will put them back, I promise.
So the game we played recently, it was a D6-based game called Song of Blades and Heroes, which I've talked about a lot on the podcast so far. I really like this game. It's fantasy miniatures skirmish rules. And I think it's quite an old game. I think it came out initially, I'm going to get this wrong, maybe 2007 or that. It might have been a bit later. Probably should have done my research there. But I think it's went through a few iterations, but it's... The gist of it is it's really simple to pick up, but it's still a lot of good fun to play. It doesn't get mundane quickly, does it? We had quite a good game the other week.
Yeah, that's right. It's like D&D for people who just want to do a wee bit of fighting on their lunch break or whatever. And for that, it's brilliant.
So you mentioned D&D. You've been doing a bit of role play for a few years, haven't you?
I did a lot as a teenager. It was either that or meet people. And but I didn't really play for a long time until lockdown, which kind of, gave me the opportunity to play again for the first time in decades. And I really thought all that sort of thing was behind me because society had moved on, but apparently it hasn't. And there are still little corners of the world where people tell stories and roll dice and have fun together, which is great.
Were you getting together to do that, or was it an online thing?
It started off online when lockdown was in its heyday. Using a system called Roll20.net, which a lot of people might be familiar with. But as things eased up a bit, we've started to play in person a bit more often, which I think is superior. But if we do go into lockdown again, there's always Roll20 to use online again, and that works pretty well too. But you can't beat the face-to-face aspect when possible.
So you're doing like an ongoing narrative with your campaigns then, or is it just little games here and there?
Yeah, no, me and the group of people, and there's a couple of games on the go, and yeah, there's like a module that the DM works from and goes through it and maybe adds bits and pieces here, but there's one game I'm in where I've been in it since like last March, and the character that I've got has gone from level 1 up to level 7, and it's really good because, you know, like role-playing games on your games consoles, you sort of grow with the character and develop them in different directions, which is a really nice aspect, which obviously isn't something that we're doing in this game, the skirmish game, but at the same time, there's a nice little bit of fun to be had there as well. So, you know, horses for courses, I guess.
Yeah, are you using miniatures for your roleplay games?
Yeah, so what we've been doing is similar to the miniatures we've been using for this game, Song of Blades and Heroes. We've got little miniatures. Like, I had to go out and find a human male paladin that I thought looked like the character that I've got. And then, you know, we've all been painting our miniatures. And that helps to realize the character as well in terms of who they are and what they would do in different circumstances. And I think that's kind of really personalizes it as well, you know. So, like, when we were playing the Song of Blades and Heroes, and I was looking at the miniatures and I couldn't help but think, like, oh, look at this guy here. I wonder what he's all about. I wonder if he really wants to be here or if he's like looking forward to the end of the battle so we can go to the pub and that kind of thing. So that's a nice little aspect.
Yeah, judging by the, I think it was your Chaos Marauder, you took a Chaos army. I think he wanted to go to the pub. He pretty much stayed put for the whole game. So did your troll.
Yeah, well, it was the Marauder I was thinking of when I was saying that, but I didn't want to start naming names as such. But yeah, he was useless. But who knows what his backstory is, right? He probably didn't want to be there in the first place, and he's, you know, this isn't his fight, and he's getting too old for this. He's seen too many battles. So that's why he deliberately made the dice come up with, like, you know, numbers that were too low for him to be activated and move. And who knows, maybe we can't blame him.
Yeah, that's I suppose, like, looking deeply into that. So in this game, like, you've got really two stats that you're paying attention to. Yeah. Let me just go to the bestiary. So you've got points stats, obviously, if you're playing a points game, but you've got a quality score and a combat score. Those are like the two core things that you're paying attention to with your characters. So your quality, that's pretty much like the lower the quality score, the better, because in order to activate a character, you're going to have to roll 1 to 3 quality dice. So if I've got a quality of 2, the only time I'm going to fail that is by rolling a 1. Whereas your combat score, the other score that you're paying attention to, you know, it could be 3, it could be 4, it could be 2. But this is essentially a number that we're adding to a D6 roll when a fight's taking place. So straight up for a beginner, that's a really good system because, like, you know, it's like if you're looking at, you know, like one of the sort of Warhammer Fantasy Battle rule sets or that, and it's just like stat line, stat line, stat line everywhere. So you could see why this game is really good for just like a beginner picking up and having a bit of fun with.
Yeah, like, you know, it comes down to maths at the end of the day, really, doesn't it? Because, I mean, that's what most D&D is anyway when it comes to realizing what's actually going to happen and deciding on the mechanics. Like, if you've got a character that has the quality of 5, so you've got to roll... No, let me get this right now. It's only been a week since we played, but if they've got a quality of 5, you've got to roll 5 or above. Is that right?
To succeed.
Yeah, so like for D&D players, you have to roll initiative each turn for each character, but not to decide who goes first, but to decide if they go at all. So you've got to roll their number or higher, and if you don't succeed, then they sit it out, which is quite interesting. Like the troll, quality 5, so what's that? If 5 or a 6, you've only got a 1 in 33% chance of him activating every turn, and that's like quite low, but... because he's quite a toughie and he's got special abilities, once he does get going, then great. Kind of like, I don't know, George Best of his day, the footballer from the 60s. Like, you know, he might not turn up every week, but when he does, whoosh, yeah, he's good.
Yeah, and like you were saying about the Marauder or any troop, you know, in real life warfare, and this isn't designed to emulate real life in any way, but there are folk that don't want to be there. There are folk of varying levels of investment or courage. So, you know, it's not a case. In some games, you're moving all your troops up the field and nobody's giving you any grief about it. You're not getting any pushback. But in this game, there are a couple of characters who, when you're trying to get everyone up there, they're kind of thinking, I don't know about this. I might just hang back here where it's a bit safer. Just how the quality activation system works. Like, you could roll between 1 to 3 dices, or die, as it is, proper term, I'll get flack for that. If you just roll the 1, that's the lowest risk, because if you fail that roll, you just move on to your next character that you want to try and activate. Or you could try and roll 2 or 3 die to give yourself potentially more activations. But if you roll, if you were to roll 2 failures and 1 success, you would get to perform that 1 action, but then you would have to pass play onto the opponent. And that happened to me quite a lot. I was playing an undead force, so I had a bit more troops than you on the ground, but they were harder to activate. You know, you've got zombies and stuff like that. Very good if you could actually get them into a fight. They've got good combat, but they're, again, like your traditional zombie films, they're very stupid, very hard to maneuver. So a lot of them just ended up sort of dossing about at the back. And... waited for you to come and claim the objectives and claim the day.
Yeah, and I must admit, my first time in playing it, I'm still getting to grips with the rules. I took very few risks in the opening rounds for that reason. And I took advantage of the fact that you were taking risks and it wasn't always coming off for you, I guess, so I could get my guys forward by rolling 1 die at a time and, you know, not risking losing the rest of the turn. So I probably gamed it a bit, even though it was meant to be just a bit of introductory fun. So semi-apologies for that, but I did win. So, I'm only a little bit sorry. A little bit.
The movement as well, I think what they do good in this game, you've got three different length sticks rather than the traditional measuring tape that you see in a lot of games. Again, nothing wrong with the measuring tape, but I think it could be a wee bit intimidating to beginners as well, because they're thinking, Christ, are we going down this intricacy, getting measuring tapes and things like that out? So just having those sticks. What are the... Just going to look here. If
short, medium, and long?
So we've got short, medium, and long. So yeah, short 75 millimeter, medium's 120, and long 180. So you're generally moving everyone with the medium stick. You had a Chaos Dwarf. He was a bit, you know, little legs. He had to move with the short stick. And these sticks are also used for things like bowmen, archers, and stuff like that as well to measure range. So very simple, just having those three sticks there. No need to be getting the tape measured out and consulting stats all the time to measure things out.
Yeah, and there's a certain amount of goodwill, I think, between the players when, like, I'll say, look, I think that will take me to there. Are you okay with that? And you're like, yeah, fine, fine. And then we move on and then we don't get overly analytical, and not like we're at a Comic Con where it's like for a big prize and we're making sure we're not taking an extra millimetre each or whatever.
Yeah, call in the invigilator and get an independent verification.
Yeah.
The combat we talked about there, so I like the combat system. Again, what ties into this is the complete lack of bookkeeping. You're not tracking wounds or anything like that. Again, nothing wrong with that. But if you just want a day where you've not got bits of paper everywhere and your pen and you're marking stuff down and then you forget and you get a bit lost. So this is really good in the way that I get into a fight with you, Robert. Well, first and foremost, if I'm going to try and fight you, it's not like a lot of games where I'm going to walk up, take a swing at you. You know, I might hit, I might miss, I might roll a wound. I'm actually going in there and you could kill me because you're going to be fighting back. So it's an active combat rather than a passive combat, if that makes sense.
Like a joust almost, where we come together for one action and one blow and then one of us comes off better or worse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we're going into combat together. We've both got a combat score. Mine could be one, yours could be five. That's obviously going to make you the heavy favourite. I don't even know if it'd be possible for me to win that, but you know, we're rolling a D6 and we're adding our combat score to that D6 roll. And it's as simple as that. So the person who comes out on top there with the cumulative score is the winner. And then you're kind of looking at a couple of things. So you're looking at if you were to win that, if you were to win your roll on an even number of your D6, I think that's where you tip them over. You basically knock them on their arse. Whereas if it's a odd number, you just push them back once.
Yeah.
So you push them back a space. So again, there's no wounds. And then we're looking at to actually kill people. We're looking at doubling or trebling their score. And that's where you're going to kill people. The most common way, I would say, of killing people is knocking them on their arse and then beating them. Because you've got heavy modifiers in your favour when you're fighting somebody who's lying on the ground. And it's quite likely when you fight them that they'll die.
Yeah, or you get your pals to come in and, you know, if you've got several of your allies all around one guy, then that also applies a modifier in your favour. So I think there's a lot of tactics there where you think, okay, I've got three skeletons and they're kind of rubbish. That one guy's pretty good, but maybe the three of them together ganging up will overcome him.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, your opponent drops a point with each opponent that they're in contact with in a combat.
Yeah.
So, you know, like you say, you're fighting three skeletons, you're going to be -3 to your roll. Either that or you as the person with the skeletons are on a +3. It's one or the other.
I don't want
to spend too much time with my nose in the book because it doesn't make for great audio, but the listener will get the gist of it.
Sure.
As is so common in this style of game, the range combat works in pretty much exactly the same way, except obviously your opponent isn't getting that chance to hit back in that turn. You know, they might be an archer and they might take a shot at you in their turn, but you're not. There's very little risk for an archer shooting at somebody. I would say that, you know, it's pretty hard to do any damage with the bow and arrow, especially against the undead. There was a modifier against those the special rules talked about the fact that with a skeleton, you know, it could just nestle in their rib cage. Zombies, you know, you're going to be doing well to take one of them out with an arrow. So that was the one of the few advantages of playing an undead warband.
That's right. Yeah, I took a mounted archer, I think it was, towards the skeletons, and that's when I realised that I was going to have trouble. And I think I hit your guy a couple of times, but never managed to do much to him, unfortunately. But, oh well, it held them up, if anything, from getting too close while my other guys were doing their thing.
The magic as well, you know, it's not a Frostgrave-style game where there's spells going off here and there and everywhere, but you do have magic users. You can take them. We had one each, you know, you had a Chaos Wizard, I had a Necromancer. But the magic works just like ranged combat. The only difference is you're declaring up front that you're going to try and do a spell, because your quality roll could have certain outcomes, certain negative outcomes if you fail it. It could just mean that your sorcerer's ran out of magic for some reason. He can't do anything else for the game.
Yeah.
And the only two spells really... a ranged attack, which could be like a fireball or that, is up to your imagination. And the other magic attack you could do is just to root somebody to the spot. So I think it's called Transfix. So I think you did it to one of my guys. You know, he was honing in on one of the little objectives, the little treasure boxes, about to have a look in there. And your wizard stepped up and just rooted him to the spot. And that was him stuck there for a wee while. So
yeah,
not an overly magic game, but it adds a nice wee bit of flavour.
That's right, yeah. I mean, they often say about D&D and other games like that, that really it's just storytelling and rolling dice, and it doesn't matter if it's a warrior or a wizard or anything else. It's still just numbers at the end of the game, you know? So, but there's enough little bits and pieces in this game to make it interesting and to make you have to think, okay, well, this my magic caster doesn't do a lot of damage, but what he could be really effective in is like you say, rooting the one guy that I really want to stop immediately from running away with a chest. So there's little things to think about like that as well. And like the skeletons being kind of having an advantage against ranged weapons. Again, there's something to think about there. And, you know, while the game is, some might describe it as simplistic in some senses, there's still enough to make you think, kind of like, you know, what they say about chess is it's easy to learn the moves, but it takes a lifetime to really understand what you can do with them.
Yeah, like one of the most overused phrases in tabletop gaming is easy to learn, hard to master.
But, yeah.
I think a lot of games achieve that. I think this game certainly does. When we start looking at some of the available models and characters you could take, that's when you can get into the competitiveness, because you could be looking at stuff and saying, okay, I could only take, you know, these three models, but they're going to be really powerful for these reasons. So a couple more things just to touch on there. First, there's morale rules, like you'll find in a lot of skirmish games, a lot of war games, that are just based on, you know, a person's in certain range of, he sees a gruesome kill, or, you know, he sees one of his comrades getting killed, he's going to have to take a quality test, he might run away. You know, morale's pretty common in this style of game. And then we've got special rules as well. That's where you go through all the, you know, I've got a certain type of character, they're this type of character, they've got this special rule, and it's usually a positive thing. You know, they've usually got some sort of positive modifier, but it could sometimes be negative. I was saying to you on the day, Robert, one of my favourites was the greedy special rule.
Oh, yeah.
So you could imagine this for, like, you know, a sneaky little goblin or Skaven type character, and that's that, you know, he kills a model, he's got to take a quality test every time he kills a foe in hand-to-hand combat, and if the test fails, he's kind of stuck beside the body for the next turn, because he's just sitting looting it, or it says he might even be, depending on the type of character, feasting on it. So just little good fluffy wee things like that that add a bit of flavour and imagination to the thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically like any board game, you know, for kids even, where, oh, I've picked up a card and it says miss one turn, which is essentially what's happening here with the goblin. But it gives you that, like you say, flavour, the kind of storytelling aspect that you could really picture the goblin rifling through the corpse's pockets and going for the jewellery and doing a little hee 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 to himself. And it really gives you that kind of theatre of the mind thing of imagining what's happening on the battlefield. And I think that really does make all the difference. This might be a semi-simplistic game compared to a long campaign in D&D, but that doesn't mean your imagination can't, you know, be fired up a little bit with what's going on the board. So I think the makers of the game have done well with that.
Yeah, and talking, like, harking back to your RPG stuff, there are, as we get later on in the book that we've got here, there are campaign rules, which I really like. You know, we've got scenarios, because, again, you know, it's fine to just line up two forces and have at it and see who's, you know, who comes out on top of the fight, but it's good to have. Like, we played one where there was some treasure boxes, I think three boxes, so you're going up to the first one, and on a roll of a 1 to 3, there's nothing in it. On a roll of a 4 to 6, you've found the treasure, if you like, and then you're going to try and carry that back off the table at your side. If you were to, you know, if the first two boxes didn't have anything in them, it was definitely going to be in that third box. So a little scenario like that. You know, we've got some other ones that I'm just looking at. We've got ones like Ambush. What else have we got here? Sorry, I'm just... So we've got Place of Power, we've got On Difficult Ground, Treasure Hunt, Quest for a Magic Item. So there's a few things there. And you can especially use that, like we've got the campaign rules where you can upgrade your equipment and stuff like that, or upgrade your special rules. Maybe there's not so much equipment rules in this game. And then the thing I like about campaign rules is always the roll tables that you have for when a character gets taken out in a game. So after the game, you're going to find out, did they die? Have they just got a horrific injury? Have they maybe come out with some weird mutation where they've emerged from it more powerful? So there's all scope for that if you're doing a bit of long-term storytelling.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I wonder if there's a scenario where, like, let's say I've got kind of like a half-broken castle and I'm trying to defend it until my forces arrive next week or whatever, and then your forces are coming to attack. So I'm not advancing towards you. I'm sort of holding back and trying to hold the line a little bit. Because that could make for interesting tactics where maybe my archers are trying to knock one or two of your guys back and then pounce on one of them who's further ahead and that sort of thing. Kind of a Helm's Deep, Lord of the Rings type thing.
Our question of the month for April 2024 is, have you ever tried to convince a 40k or Age of Sigmar player to play a non-GW miniatures game? If so, what was the response? What game did you play? And crucially, did they enjoy it? I'd love to hear about your own experiences on this front, and you could record your audio feedback by going to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now, back to the show. Yeah, and I like that because, again, you know, some wargamers, there's no wrong way to play, but some people like this idea of, we've got these very well-matched, fair forces with equal points totals. You know, it's almost game of chess style. Let's see who can come out on top.
Yeah.
But I quite like the scenario-based, like you're saying, let's take these three dwarfs and this human archer and hold out against these 50 zombies. You know, we're going to die, but let's see how many of them we could take out first. Let's see how many turns we could stand out for. Because, again, that could be part of a scenario where it is, you know, these guys are heroes, they're martyrs, because they're buying time for somebody else to escape or whatever. So it's not always about a sort of fair game of football, if you like.
No, let's just see what happens. And, you know, it's not always about who wins or loses, right? And you know, and a lot of the fantasy books, they often say things like, oh, 1,000 men in a fortified castle could defend it against 10,000 attackers, 10 to 1. And it's all about the ground that you're stood on. So maybe we could see if that plays out in a kind of tabletop mathematical kind of scenario as well, and just see how it goes. That could be a lot of fun as well. And, you know, you don't have to worry about necessarily winning or not, because the fun is in taking part.
Yeah, and you get an opponent who takes it too seriously and they're saying, I'm just going to starve them out, seeing as they're in here. So 4 hours later, he's just not done anything. He's just surrounded you and went for a coffee.
Right, okay, well, same time next week, or we could do something else.
just looking at the two forces, I've still got the wee army lists. It's not really armies, it's warbands, but you played Chaos, so you had a Marauder, a Goblin Warrior, a Chaos Dwarf, a Beastman, a Barbarian Archer, a Troll, a Goblin Assassin, a Chaos Sorcerer, and a Mounted Chaos Warrior. So very Battlemaster-esque or HeroQuest-esque list where the Goblins and the Chaos all mucked in together. On the Undead side, for me, Necromancer, Ghost, 3 Skeleton Warriors, 2 Skeleton Archers, and 6 Zombies. The Zombies were worse than useless. They had a quality 5 to activate. They did have a combat score of 4, so if I was on a really good day, which is never going to happen, let's face it, if I was able to get them into some fights, then they would do a bit of damage, but it's not going to be easy to manage that.
Yeah, and with a quality of 5, so 5 out of 6, 33% chance of moving, it was going to take you forever to get them all, as a group even, up to the other side of the board. So that was a difficult one. But yeah, I don't think I really fought your zombies, to be honest, or maybe your skeletons.
Nah, they never got near you, yeah. Well. I liked you had the Goblin Assassin, so he had a special rule. He had a couple of special rules. He had Assassin and Stealth. Stealth was a funny one. He could be pressed against a castle wall or house or something. And even if you're standing like right across from him, you just can't see him, apparently. So you can't take a pop at him or that with ranged weapons or magic. But the Assassin one, from what I remember, you just had to win a combat by a single point, which would usually mean you've pushed somebody away and no more than that. But this character, this special rule, you're basically killing them with that 1 point win. You're assuming he's got maybe a poison dagger or something like that.
Yeah, he knows where to stab. He's not just hacking and slashing. He's got the dagger in the jugular. I must admit, once I got a hang of the rules and I was looking at his abilities, I thought, this guy, he's the key. He's kind of overpowered compared to a lot of the other characters. So that's why I was like, right, he's going for the chest. Because, you know, like you touched it before, in order to actually kill someone, you have to double their score once you've both added and subtracted your bits and pieces. So I roll a die and it comes out that my total is 8 and yours is 4. And only because it's double would I win. But this guy, as you say, you roll a 4, I roll a 5 and you're gone. That's you know, that's brutal. So he was by far my favourite.
Yeah, and to balance him, obviously, he's well, quality 3 is pretty good, to be honest. But he's combat 2, so you're still wanting a good role in combat to try and come out on top. It's not like he's adding a 4 to that or anything. So otherwise, he'd just be pretty much invincible, wouldn't he?
I guess you want someone else to be going up to the enemy and possibly knocking him over. So the guy's on the ground, he's prone, which is like a -1. Then your assassin comes up, your pal who's knocked him over is next him, so that's another -1. So the assassin's combat 2 is actually combat 4 equivalent. So again, that's the kind of tactics you're thinking, right? Get the other guy to do the hard work in helping you with the bonuses, and then the sneaky little assassin comes in out of the shadows and it's all over.
I was having a look at the profiles at the back of the sort of things you could take. So I think the game we played, it was roughly, would have been like 350 points or something like that. And as far as I could see, the best thing you could take in the game, in this core rules book, is the Ancient Dragon, who sets you back 268 points, a quality of 2 and a combat of 6. So, I mean, you're going to be rampaging through forces with that, aren't you? Like, you would need to roll a 1 to not be able to take a turn, for starters. And then when you're going into combat with a score of 6, and he's got a whole raft of special rules as well. He's a magic user, long move, shooter, terror, tough, flying, huge. You could take that on its own, you know. And if you had the room just to get maybe a human on a horse or something like that, just for that extra bit of, you know, if you've got a claim and objective, send the dragon in, cause absolute chaos, and just have this guy whistling on the back of his horse, trotting along with whatever it was he was sent to pick up.
I'm pretty sure if either of us had just the dragon and the other person just had their normal army or warband, then the dragon would win, especially, you know, breathing from afar. Like, I'm going to breathe on you, then I'm going to move over here, and what are you going to do about it? Nothing.
Yeah.
And there's the little marauder guy with his little hand axe going, oh, I'll get you. if I can get going, if I roll high enough, but not this turn. Like, yeah. I think it would only be fair if you both had a dragon each, but even that would be ridiculously messy. You just have the two dragons left at the end.
Yeah, that wouldn't even be fun, eh? Just two of them going at it and not managing anything. I don't have a dragon miniature, but it's a good reason to maybe pick one up just to try that. It'd have to be the, what was the book in the film? Was it Gulliver, where he gets overwhelmed by all the tiny wee guys?
It'd
have to be kind of like that. You've just got people surrounding him, trying to sort of weigh him down, pin him down.
Like ants on a spider.
Yeah, yeah. You get other dragons too, and they're pretty good, like adult dragon, small dragon, hydra. There's a lot of cool, interesting profiles here, stuff that you don't see in a lot of games. We've got like mermen, we've got hyena men, blobs, molds, and fungi. You could take a fungus man for 13 points, quality 5, combat 2, special rules, poison. We've got trolls, which we played with one of them.
Yeah.
Rat men, cat folk, halflings, so we're going a bit Tolkien there. Bugbears. Bugbears are kind of, they're kind of animalish creatures, aren't they? Or are they goblinoid?
Yeah, they are. I've fought a couple in D&D and I've suddenly gone blank on what a bugbear looks like. But yeah, I believe kind of like, like bear men type thing. I'm probably making a fool of myself by saying that. I'm actually going to Google it now and just see what a bugbear looks like. Yeah, kind of like, well, it's got pointy ears and it's big and tall and it's kind of hairy, so... I should have seen them living around here, actually. Your classic fantasy type thing. Imagine an orc, but slightly hairier.
A hair orc.
Yeah.
The undead force here, vampire lord, looks pretty good. You know what? I had a great vampire miniature from the old Warhammer range.
Oh yeah.
And I sold it. I found all my miniatures and, you know, these undead ones, and I sold them all in a batch, and I regret selling that vampire because I wish I'd stripped that and painted it up again. especially because I'm actually reading, I think I told you this before, Robert, I'm reading Bram Stoker's Dracula, the original vampire novel. I'm reading that at the moment. It was written about 1897. Dracula not in it that often, I'll be honest with you. He's never a first person character. It's all just, you know, he pops up here at the start and we go quite a long way with it, encounter now and again, and you get a bit of him at the end, but...
it's all about the journey.
Yeah, you could almost take the other perspective of this book is about like four guys in Britain trying to get this Romanian immigrant out the country, you know, if you want to flip it on its head, because that's essentially what's happening, but they have their reasons. I mean, he's murdered one of their partners already, so... you know, we have to sympathise there. But yeah, the guys are off to Transylvania now because he's fled back there. So hoping that it ends on a positive note for the goodies.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. It's not one I've actually read, to be honest. And it's one of those like, yeah, I should read it because it's the classic one. But
yeah, it's been a slog in places. Old books can be flowery. As somebody who's read a lot of Lovecraft. I mean, he came a bit later than that. He was, what, 1920s, I think. But, you know, you can find yourself rolling your eyes sometimes with the older stuff just because it's, you know, so much has been done after that that's been influenced by it. So
yeah, I did hear someone once say that they don't like Shakespeare stuff because it's also full of cliches. Like,
yeah.
Well, yeah, it is now. But yeah, like I'd imagine there'll be bits in Dracula where the guy, I mean, does have a name, but it was, yeah, they'll be describing 6 pages worth of a horseless carriage because, you know, in 1897, not everyone's been in one, but you and I are like
six films with them. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just move this along. And a lot of people say that about Tolkien, that he describes things to the absolute nth degree. And some people love that. I remember a friend of mine saying, oh, so rich in detail, the history, the lore and all that. And other people going, when did he get somewhere and do something?
When he stabbed somebody.
Yeah, let's have a Barney. Come on, let's go. Let's do it. Let's fight some orcs. And, oh, no, we're talking about the trees and the Council of Trees again. Cool.
So just swinging back to Song of Blades and Heroes, going to get another game of this in soon, I'm assuming. So you're going to put your own wee warband together this time, take me by surprise.
Yeah, it's all good guy characters I've got, though. I've got a polar bear, a dire wolf, a paladin, an elven druid, and one more I've forgotten. But yeah.
Polar bear's a funny one. Is that just a miniature you picked up along the way at some point?
Yeah, well, it's because my druid turns into a polar bear in order to fight things. He's basically a big, tough polar bear. And that's like, for his level, that's the strongest creature or the most handy creature you can turn into, because got lots of hit points and stand up front and take all the damage.
Giant bear, 40 points, quality 3, combat 4, special rules, animal and big. There what go. The animal special rule is. you have to pick up his shit in a bag or you get in trouble off the council.
Yeah, well, that's a good one.
Oh, it says animal models do not receive experience points in campaigns. Animals cannot use magic items. Animals automatically route when the last non-animal model in their warband is killed.
Oh, well. Well, that's kind of similar, because once you turn into a bear, you can't then, as a druid, cast spells in D&D, but you can maintain one in your head if you cast it beforehand. So kind of similar. And same with large, like, you have like normal sizes and large and monstrous and all that stuff. And when I turn into a bear, I then take up 4 squares as a polar bear. So that's kind of similar that way as well.
Are your miniatures, are they plastic or metal?
Resin, kind of plastic resin.
Yeah, aye. I've got the stuff we, like, it was all my stuff we played with, just to give you an introduction to the game. But the plastic ones, they were mainly plastic, and I feel much safer playing with them, but they weren't my best models. I've got a lot better than that, you know, it's a lot better painted stuff that I'd like to take, but playing with metal, I'm scared of it, because you just have to, like, rub it the wrong way and it chips. Even if you put a good coat of varnish on them after you've painted them, they're very easily chipped, so...
Yeah.
Don't know if I'd spend the whole game just being like, oh no, like, has he fell over, or... Has the dice hit them?
Yeah, oh, that is possible. The good thing about these models I've got is, like, they bend a little bit. They've got a bit of give in them. So, I mean, I try to be careful when I'm putting them in the box, especially my druid, for some reason, he holds his staff so it's kind of pointing forwards, you know, rather than just holding it up, like, to attention. So I'm always putting him on his side, making sure his staff doesn't bend too much. But it has a bit of give to it.
Yeah, so some of the models that I was using, they were from Mantic's Dungeon Saga game, which is a kind of modern version of HeroQuest, which is quite topical at the moment, time of recording, because we were just talking about that, Robert, that they've brought a modern-day version of that out.
Yeah. So
that was a game you played as a young man, wasn't it?
It was. 11 or 12 years old. It was on TV and the adverts all the time, and it looked like the absolute best thing ever. And I loved it. Yeah, played it for a good few years, probably well into high school, secretly. But, you know, I have no such social fears anymore about what people think, and I'm ready to play again once I've saved up enough money to buy it.
Yeah, well, good news on that front. Like, I've got Dungeon Saga, which is, well, firstly, I think it was a lot cheaper than what they're going to be taking for this new copy of HeroQuest. But, you know, it's a bit more modern as well. I think, as far as I know, I don't know a huge amount about it, but HeroQuest have apparently kept some of their very old school rules, like the movement is a D6, so, you know, you could just be moving a square per turn if you roll badly. I think that's a bit dated, to be honest. I don't know. I know almost nothing about games design, but that seems a bit dated, that sort of mechanic, so...
Well, there's not a lot of storyline reason for it, really, is it? It's like, oh, my sorcerer decides he hasn't got the same energy as he had last turn when he rolled a 6.
Yeah, it's too random, isn't it? Without any relevance to the story or anything like that. But Dungeon Saga, I've had a couple of playthroughs with my wife last winter. We managed a couple of those. And it's a good game, really good, solid B game. So we'll need to get a game of that sorted out as well.
Excellent,
because it follows the same ethos of being very easy to pick up, but quite challenging, and also you're not going to need 4 or 5 hours one night to play it. You know, you're going to bash through it a bit quicker than that. So,
Yeah.
There's something about that aesthetic of the dungeon tiles and the doors and the furniture and that as well, isn't there?
Yeah. Ah, you can let your imagination go a little bit again. And I'm glad to hear that it's a bit more affordable for the, what's your dungeon quest, did you call it?
Yeah, Dungeon Saga. Dungeon Saga.
Hero Quest and Dungeon Saga mixed up.
There will be a dungeon quest.
Almost certainly, yeah. But it was interesting that the new Hero Quest was coming in at $100, which I think I worked out to be about £93, which seems a lot for a board game. I mean, it better be a pretty good board game, right?
Yeah, well, that's like games, you know, like the argument with computer games, and it's a valid one. Like when you see an Xbox game for £60 or whatever they go for now, and you think, well, if that's Skyrim and I play that for 2,000 hours, that's a very good deal. Right. So if you were buying HeroQuest for £90 and you genuinely did play it every single weekend for a year, then yeah, you're getting great value. But I just doubt that. You know, I think if you're the type of person who's buying this, you're either buying it purely for the nostalgia and you might not play it, you might not even play it, or you're the type of person who's just got so many games and you want to add this to your collection and you might play it twice or something, and then it's a £45 a turn sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember, you know, in the arcades, the, you know, video game arcades, and we'd put pound after pound into machines and then come away and that was it. And we didn't even own anything. You basically rented a couple of minutes worth of fun. And if you compare that to a game that you might buy for £40 or something and you play the absolute legs off it for a couple of years, then yeah, you've got to think about the long term, of course. But like you say, the Hero Quest, obviously going for the nostalgia value. I do wonder if there aren't already games out there that would satisfy what else you would get out of it beyond the nostalgia. So I do think that's a big price to ask, especially when there's so many other games out there. I mean, like I got to play a board game for the first time called Scythe, and it's a board game. It's not like a miniature wargaming thing, but it was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And I looked it up thinking, I want to get that. It must be, what, 10, 15, 20 pounds? And it was 40-odd quid. And I thought, oh, that's a lot of money for a board game. But it's because I haven't bought a board game in so long that inflation has gone up since the 90s, you know?
Yeah, aye.
But yeah, if we did play it several hours a time, several times a year, that alone would be worth it compared to you go to the cinema and pay £15 to watch a film in 90 minutes and it's done.
Yeah. Yeah, you could easily lose £40 in a pub. No problem at all in a couple of hours, as we often have.
Yes. And I'm willing to do again, funnily enough.
Yeah, we'll take Dungeon Saga. We'll find the roughest pub we can in the area and we'll get Dungeon Saga set up and we'll annoy somebody just by the sound of constantly rolling dice. And funny accents, and then we'll see what injuries we could obtain on the campaign role chart at the end.
I'll wear my Star Trek Pink Floyd mashup t-shirt because I really like that t-shirt and it'll help me make friends.
I've rolled a one which on the chart here it says a broken pint tumbler up arse. So I have to miss the next game whilst the doctor pulls it out and I explain the story to him. You know, this isn't what it looks like, Doctor.
Yeah, missed several turns because you had to walk home instead of getting the taxi because you didn't want to sit down.
Good stuff. So I will pencil that game in soon. And it's been good to just chat about the game as well. I really like it. I hope, you know, it's a very famous game and this isn't a very famous podcast. But, you know, if a couple of people hear of it for the first time and want to check it out, then I'll be delighted with that.
Yeah, definitely. And nobody should be put off by it being simplistic in any way because, you know, like I said before, horses for courses. And even D&D itself became quite complicated with its rules. You had all sorts of flanking rules and cover rules that don't exist. Well, they took out of it and made it a bit simpler. Like version 3.5 had a lot more rules, I think. I haven't actually played that version myself, but I play version 5, the more modern one. And that can be semi-simplistic where they say, oh, we don't worry about that sort of thing, which way you're facing or flanking. It's just to sort of make it a bit more playable and make the game run a bit more smoothly. And they do that in sport as well. You know, they make sort of circumstances where they allow the play to keep going, like play advantage, just because you want the flow of the game to keep going. So if you do enjoy anything at all about the kind of mechanics and the strategy involved in combat, which surely most people do if they do any kind of role-playing, then I think this is a great little pick-me-up and something to fill a little bit of time. I mean, video game players as well, they'll say the same thing, that they like your long-term games where you have to spend 6 hours doing this, that, and the other because you're building towards something. But once in a while, it's great to pick up a game and, let's say, a golf game and just play one round of golf, put it back down again and go back to your life.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode. Remember, if you're enjoying the podcast so far, then a wee rating and review on your listening app of choice would be massively appreciated. And if you want to get in touch with the show for any reason at all, you could do so over at bedroombattlefields.com/contact.